You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. October the 10th marks World Mental Health Day. Mental health is perhaps an unreported and under-discussed issue in the world of snooker. Here, after all, is an almost uniquely individual sport. The mentality to play snooker at the highest level requires players to retreat into themselves. It's no coincidence that so many of the sport's great champions have been introverts. But is this, in fact, creating wider problems? Away from any perceived glamour, the professional snooker circuit involves a lot of time, indeed arguably too much time, for introspection. The plane journeys, the nights alone in hotel rooms, etc. More than one player has found themselves feeling isolated, anxious and depressed. One of them is Martin Gould, who spoke at the end of last season about his own problems. Martin speaks to me in this podcast, in his own words, about his own story. He hopes it will encourage others who are going through a rough time to seek help, particularly men for whom the subject of mental health is often taboo. The biggest single killer of men under 50 in Britain is suicide. This is a stark fact, but there is help out there. The WPBSA are working with Sporting Chance, set up by former Arsenal and England footballer Tony Adams. They offer confidential support for emotional and behavioural problems. The WPBSA also work with the charity Silence of Suicide, a free and confidential service which offers people the opportunity to discuss their emotional well-being. Neil Tompkins, who Martin mentions, is the WPBSA's first dedicated players' relations manager, someone who can help players find the best possible help. The interview with Martin Gould talks through his snooker career and concludes with us discussing his recent problems. In the best traditions of this podcast, there's some background noise. We were at the Championship League and there was other stuff going on backstage. Martin also swears briefly and is immediately regretful, but I think we can all get over that. You can check out more information about the issues discussed here on WPSA.com. But now here's the Snooker Scene Podcast with Martin Gould. Martin, how did you discover snooker?
I was probably around about 2 years old, something like that. My dad religiously used to watch the World Championship. The story I've been told was when I was about a little nipper, having nappy changed, then put into my cot to be go to sleep. Apparently, I heard the snooker music and it was like I rose from the dead. And apparently, I just sat up and I started watching TV. So I suppose they took that as a bit of a sign. Maybe I just liked the music, I'm not sure. But sort of from about 2.5, 3, I always had a small little table in the house and you could never get me off it. My sister brought me a little bit of a 5x3 or 6x3 when I was sort of a little bit older and a little bit taller. And again, you just could not get me off it.
Mm. I mean, that's young though, isn't it? 2 or 3, I mean, we hear like Stephen Hendry, was 11 when he got his small table, but that's young. What do you think it was? Can you explain why you were attracted to it?
I don't know, it was just one of those. I heard the music. And it just seemed as though it was just something that I obviously liked. Obviously, I wouldn't have had a clue what was going on, but I used to, like my dad always used to have the 2 weeks off for the World Championship, because you never, back in them days, the good days, you used to never miss a ball. Now you have to press red buttons, this button, that button, come back 3 days later and watch the decider and stuff like that. So I've always watched it with my dad. My dad does, no one in my family really, my dad plays a little bit. What I used to, could never, his highest break was only 35, so it's not like he played much. When I was about 8, 9, I got barred from the local pub across the road because I was beating all the adults on the pool table. They moved the age to 14, and when I turned 14, they moved it to 16. So yeah, I've had some fun and games trying to play at times. But the pool team across the road from me, when I was about 9, 10, they wanted me to play for them. So what we had to do is we used to get both sets of teams to crowd around the pool table so no one could see over, just so I could play. Obviously, it was handy because I was short. So, but yeah.
So, and when did you sort of progress to like full size snooker tables, and did you start entering like the junior events and so on?
No, I never played a junior event, anything like that. Started playing probably on the full size table 12, 13. I used to go Riley's in Harrow and Wealdstone. They used to do like under 16 tournaments every like Saturday or Sunday, and I used to win all of them. It got to the point where a lot of people didn't want to play anymore because they just said, well, might as well just give him the money now. Stuff like that. But I never had a coach. I had one brief coaching lesson when I was about 13 from Jeff Folbes, and the only thing that he asked me to change was just how I used to bridge, because I don't know if people were aware of this. I didn't have the conventional hand down like that. I used to have my thumb over the top of the cue, and so I used to cue underneath. That was the only thing that he asked me to change. He said other than that, everything else was okay. Once I turned 18, I stopped playing pool. I used to play pool for London, England. I've won the European Junior Under 18s European Championship, lost in the final of the World Juniors as well to Kurt Morris, won loads of team events with England at pool and stuff like that. And then once I turned 18, I just went, right, going to snooker now, play on the Challenge Tour. I didn't play any other events. So the first couple of years or so on the Challenge Tour literally were, if I didn't win, if I didn't win a frame in one visit, I didn't win a frame. I used to lose matches 4-3 because I refused to play safe. I just used to go for everything, pretty much like I am now. But yeah, back in them days, I was a little bit too raw. So
did you see that was something like that could be a career, or were you just sort of playing because you like playing?
Something that I wanted to do for a career. Obviously, you always get people telling you you're not going to be good enough and so on, and it was a little part of me in my backbone that was like, oh, I'm going to prove all you lot wrong and say, like, I am capable. And I think I've shut a few people up over the years, so prove people wrong. But yeah, I did enjoy it as well. But yeah, I didn't play much snooker. I used to play snooker a lot, but I didn't play any tournaments or anything like that as a kid. I remember being 18 playing first Challenge Tour event. People were looking at me going, who the hell is this? We used to have Monday night competitions in my old snooker club in North Harrow, and like people used to turn up that would be there. Obviously it was handicapped, and they'd take one look at me and they'd be like, oh, I want to draw him. Because they're looking at me and they're thinking, well, he obviously can't play that much. And then like one of them actually happened to draw me, and I pumped in 130 first poke, and he was like, maybe I don't want to play you then. So,
but 2002, you won the English amateur title. Now, obviously, that's, you know, a very recognised event.
Yeah.
That was a breakthrough of sorts, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I didn't even know nothing about it. It was only one of the Challenge Tour events in Swindon. Malcolm Form pulled me to one side. He said, I don't know if you're interested, but they're doing an English amateur event. Maybe you might fancy it. Yeah, why not? Give it a crack. Didn't expect to win it on my first attempt. I remember we played the final, funny enough, in King's Lynn, and I was just in King's Lynn a couple of weeks ago visiting my sister because she's moved down towards that way. And I couldn't find, I had no recollection where the club was, but I think the club's still there. Didn't get a chance to go and see it, so it would have been nice to have just nipped in and just seen if what was different about the place. But yeah, it was, yeah, I just remember, I think I beat Martin O'Donnell on the way. That was think I'll beat Alex Davis and Craig Taylor in the final. I think I'll beat Ben Fitzgerald along the way as well. But yeah, it was just one of those weird experiences. Just didn't expect it, and I happened to win it, so it was great.
And then you eventually you're on the pro tour. It was a different time to now. There weren't as many tournaments, but what was that like? Because suddenly it's sort of serious then, isn't it? It is literally a profession.
Yeah, well, I winning the English amateurs didn't actually get me on the tour though. I think there was some strings pulled to stop me from getting on, because normally the English amateur champion at that time got a spot, and it went to someone else. I think it was someone like Ricky Walden or someone got the spot. So that got my back up a little bit, and then I finished number one on a challenge tour the following year. So I was like, you can't stop me now. unless you find a way of physically stopping me, there is no way you can stop me now. So I got on through the challenge tour. But the 2003-04 season, the first few events, only having six, it was really difficult. And then my mum fell really ill. She fell ill just over that Christmas and deteriorated very dramatically, and that kind of made me not want to play. I remember going to play the Welsh Open qualifiers in Pontins, and just before I was leaving, my sister rung me and she goes, before you go, can you pop into the hospital? Yeah, sure, what's up? She said, no, just pop in, the doctors want to talk to you. And I'm like, what do the doctors want to talk to me for? So I popped in, and I've seen my mum first and spoke to her, and she had a look on her face as if, I don't know if she actually knew or whether anyone had said anything to her, but they had spoke to her and said, well, she had that look on her face as if she knew something was wrong, because like for me to have had to have turned up. So the doctor pulled me in and literally said, your mum's got probably 3 to 6 months. Oh, pardon. I was like, what the hell? So I walked back in just to see my mum before I went, and she could tell that, because I looked like a ghost, because I just turned white. And I spoke to her and I said, look, if you don't want me to go, I won't go. She said, no, you go and do your job. And I'm like, how am I supposed to do my job now? I'm like, I remember I played Lee Walker in the match that I had to play, and 1 minute I was fine, next minute it just, like, everything was hitting me, and then I lost 5-3, I think it was. I just remember just wanting to just give it all up. I didn't want to play. I was like, I wanted to try and do as much as I could to keep my mum with me as long as possible. In the end, we brought my mum home, so I was basically a living carer. Me and my sister took it in turns. Like, sometimes my sister would come in the morning, or I'd come in the evening. I lived there anyway, so we had obviously your carers coming in and stuff. But yeah, me and my sister did everything together. And then, in fact, that actually brought me and my sister probably a lot closer together. Yeah. We had sort of drifted. And then I think that sort of just said, well, instead of being so far apart, that just drifted me and her together. I have got a half brother as well, and I won't say too much about him. We don't talk. I've not really spoke to him for about 15 years, maybe even longer. The last time I spoke to him was when his dad passed away. Obviously I've got different father to them, but same mother. And I was obviously a little bit upset for him and my sister when he passed away. I think that was 2015, because I think it was just before I went to Australia. So, but yeah, that was 2003-04. I think I played 1 year on the Pios tour the following year. My heart was just not in it. Financially, I couldn't afford to do it either. A lot of travelling. I was just turning up to events going, right, looking at draws and going, well, if I can nick that one, that pays that bill. If I can nick that match, it pays that bill. And in the end, it just got to the point where I was like, I have to get a proper job. And I started working a bit instead of playing snooker. And in all fairness, I didn't actually miss it.
Well, I was going to ask you that because, you know, you said you've been gripped by it since you were at two.
Yeah.
But I guess sort of real life took over a little bit, didn't it?
Real life. I had to grow up very quickly. I realised now I've got no one to literally wipe my backside anymore. I've got to do everything myself. So I had to grow up. I was only 22 at the time when my mum died. So literally I'm still a little kid.
Yeah.
I'm still getting away with murder at that point. And now all of a sudden my life's completely changed. So yeah, my dad then moved away 6 months after my mum passed away. So I literally it just felt like I was on my own. It was a case of, like I say, just didn't miss playing snooker. I'd played the odd game now and again, just with a couple of friends, and it was sort of like 06 where a mate of mine said to me, look, seriously, I don't want you to waste your life not playing snooker. We all know how good you are. And he entered me without telling me in the English amateurs for 07. So I just remember seeing this big huge envelope on the floor back in the day when we used to receive postal draws and stuff. Obviously not like it is now where it's all online. And I remember just seeing this big envelope and I was like, Jesus, is this? So I've opened it and I'm looking and I've seen my name and it says that I'm playing so and so and so and so on this day. I'm like, I rung the ASB up and I said, is there some mistake? And they went, no, you paid your entry. And I went, I never paid no entry. Well, your name's in the draw. If you don't want to play, don't turn up. I was like, okay, well, I looked at it and I rung one person up that I thought it could be, and his name was Paul Brennan. And I said to him, did you enter me in this event? He's gone, yeah. He said, I'm going to take you to wherever it's got to be, I'll take you as well. He said, don't worry about anything. I was like, okay, on your back it is. I said, I'll tell you now, I'm not going to practice for it. I'll just have a quick knock beforehand and just go. I ended up winning it.
Yeah.
So, and then, but in that time, when it got to the nitty gritty part, a company had contacted me, Super Tough Glass, and they said to me, look, if you do get your tour card, we'll sponsor you for a couple of seasons and see how it goes, and we'll go from there. And I was with them for about 6-7 seasons. They did a lot for me. I'm hoping I did a lot for them as well. So
it should be said as well, that English amateur final, I think David Lilley went in off the last black, which is a kind of, I mean, it's a bizarre way you ended up in it, but a bizarre way to end as well.
Yeah, it was. The black was on the black cushion, white was sort of just halfway between the pink spot, black spot, on towards the side cushion. I'm looking at him and I can see him lining up the black and I'm thinking, on the star table, yeah, take this on all day, you ain't putting this. And I just see the black wobble and it drop. And I was like, wow, fair play. And my head did drop. But an instinct just told me to look up. And as I looked up, I could see the white going straight in the middle pocket. There was no, unless it took a huge roll off, it was going nowhere but in the middle of the pocket. Well, obviously, all the David's fans and friends and that were cheering. I only had my dad sat in the back row. My dad was obviously was upset, and then all of a sudden I caught his eye and I said, watch the cue ball. He was like, what? I said, watch the white ball. And then all of a sudden the white dropped in, all of his mates have just gone like that, and he's fallen to the floor, and my dad's jumped up and I'm gone, get the in there. And I was like, I've now looked, I want to look away, because I'm thinking now this could end up in a riot, because it's only me and him against that lot. So, but yeah, it was a good final. It was pretty good standard, to be fair. I think that there was one frame in it what I stole from him. I needed, I think, four snookers, and I managed to pinch it, and that kind of helped me win it. And then since winning English amateurs, I've never really looked back.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've spoken to Dave. Dave's obviously seen me a couple of times. I still think it must still hurt him. I'm pretty sure it does. It probably hurts him just as much seeing me progress the way I have as well. I don't mean that in a bad way or anything, but he's thinking that could have been me.
So you get back on the tour, and I remember you beat Hendry at the Welsh. I think it was 2009.
Yeah.
You would sort of known about it before then, but that seemed like a big result because he was, you know, Stephen Hendry. He's on television. Did that feel that way to you as well?
It was one of those type of games where I actually felt that I could beat him. Even though I probably didn't have as many results behind me, I'd had actually had a good run prior to that, because I think I qualified for the UK that year. I won three matches to qualify for the UK, and I lost to Murphy 9-7. Murphy went on to win it. But I remember playing Matthew. I played my first TV game in Northern Ireland, and then I lost to Hendry the following game. So, and Hendry beat me 5-3, and I got the better of him that time 5-3. So I kind of knew that that was a very winnable game. I knew I'm still playing a legend of the game at that time, but it was one of those where I did fancy causing an upset. But I think Joe Swale beat me in the following round. But it was just all very good learning curve for me. Like, just nicking matches, and they virtually guaranteed me to stay on tour as well. And I think I ended up qualifying for the Worlds that year as well, and lost to Mark Allen. So that was the icing on the cake of a great season. But the Grand Prix was the event in that year that helped me. Because even though there was only six events, the Grand Prix was round robin. So I got like 5-6 matches in the group. And I think that actually did me the world of good, because it gave me a few more matches rather than maybe just playing one. And then who knows, I may not have been sat here right now.
Yeah. You mentioned the Crucible, of course, 2010, qualified again. You know what I'm going to talk about, obviously, the Neil Robertson match.
What happened? I have no recollection. I've had that erased permanently from my memory.
Well, let me remind you. No, I mean, I think that's a perfect example of the sort of the unique nature of that tournament, because there's no other event where you're playing over a series of days, and you, I think you actually said afterwards, you said, well, I'd never been 11-5 before in the World Championship. You're going into the next day, new territory.
Yeah. The game against Marco was, like, I'd played a couple of best of 19s, but never in that sort of environment. So to have won that match there, it kind of just, it took the shackles off. I just went out and just wanted to play snooker against Neil. And if that match could have finished on the Friday night, there's no way he would have won. No way. I don't care who you are and what you say, there's no way he would have won. I think I would have won 13-5, 13-6 without doubt, because I was on fire. I was on fire, literally. And the next day I just woke up, went to the practice room for that final session, and it felt like somebody had taken my right arm and exchanged it with someone else's. I just felt I couldn't hit a ball. I got out there into the arena. I think I missed a black off the spot very early. That kind of unsettled me. And Ollie's going to hate me for this, but I'm going to have to mention the fact that when I actually did get my first opportunity, Ollie picked up the white by mistake.
The Levi Montiel.
Yeah. I still remind him of it now. I know it's a long time ago, 10 years, but that done me up as well, because I think it was 11-7 when I finally got an opportunity, and I felt like I was just getting myself back into how good I was feeling. And I potted a pink in the corner, and funny enough, Michaela had done it in the morning when I think it was Maguire against Dot, but that was not an important time. I think it was 10-1 or 10-2 at the time, whereas this is 11-7, and it's my first opportunity of final session, and I'm like, it took four or so minutes for him to replace everything, and I was like, and then I missed the next red, and then I didn't get another shot until about 11-10. So I'm now thinking that I'm destined here to fall apart. In all honesty, I don't even know how I won a frame in that final session. I think I went 12-10, then it went 12-11, 12-12. And at 12-12, it was probably the best I ever felt in the whole that final session. I felt like I could win it in one visit. And I think I made 40, and I played a red to the green hole. And I was walking as soon as I hit it, because I'm thinking it's in, and it's rattled and stayed there. And then it was game over. So, yeah, it was a bitter taste, but I used it to my advantage. I was like, it was a match where there was so many positives to take from it. I was like, I just said to myself, just keep playing this style of snooker rather than being negative or anything like that. But not so much playing not to lose, it was just I wasn't really expressing myself properly, because leading up to the World Championship, that was what actually did me a massive favour. I played in the mixed pairs in, I think they played it in, it wasn't the Northern Snooker Centre, they played it somewhere else. And I played with Pam Wood. Obviously, I didn't know what to expect from Pam because I'd never seen her play. She could play a little bit, don't get me wrong. She basically asked for my advice as the match went on, the matches went on. And she pulled out a great couple of clearances when we needed them. But I just went there with the philosophy of going, right, I'm going to have to go for everything here. And it worked. We may have lost in the final to Joe and his partner, but I was like, I found something.
Mm.
And I took that with me to the Crucible and I used that. And then I was like, yeah, this is the way for me to play snooker, all out attack.
Yeah, and after that, in the next couple of years, things did start to happen for you. You know, yeah. you got in the top 16, you won Power Snooker, you won a PTC, you won the Shootout. You were becoming a top player, weren't you?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, you did actually, like you say, you did ultimately take the positives from that.
Yeah, yeah. A few people criticised me because I stayed in Sheffield after I lost to Neil. And I was like, why would I want to go home and dwell on it? Mm. If I can stay here in the moment, all right, if people want to keep asking me questions about it, yeah, let them. But I thought to myself, if I go home, I might just sit there and I'll be... start thinking too much about it and maybe wanting to re-watch it or anything like that. And I was like, no, I'm staying in Sheffield. I'm going to enjoy myself here. Stay in the moment, stay with what was going on. And I think that also helped because, like I say, I didn't go home. I stayed there and I just... some people obviously said, how have you lost? It happens.
Mm.
But for me, I thought that it did me a world of good staying up there. Just keeping in that bubble, shall we say,
yeah,
of what was going on, and just use that to move forward. And yeah, that was when the ranking system started to change as well, because I think I went from like 46 to like 18 or 20, and I was like, blimey, I've jumped 28 places and I've not hit a ball. So, and then I got in the 16, qualified. One thing that did upset me a little bit when I got in the 16 was he moved the Masters from off my back doorstep to Halle-Pally.
Mm.
Would have loved to have played at Wembley, just literally right on my doorstep. But just to have played at the Masters has been great. I'd love to play there again.
Mm.
I haven't had the opportunity, but there's still plenty of time yet. You never know. Stranger things can happen.
Definitely. And then we look at the 2015-16 season. Obviously, you get to the final in Australia, lose a really good match with John Higgins. And then, of course, the following February in Berlin at the Tempodrome, which is a fantastic event, fantastic venue. You win your first ranking title. That must have been a very special moment.
Yeah, the Aussie was... I felt that that week was my week.
Mm.
I felt that I was by far the best player in that event. And to come up one frame short, yeah, I was devastated. But I said to myself, that's a great platform to work with for the rest of the season. We got to York, the infamous David Grace game. That was that season.
Yeah.
5-1 up, lost 6-5. I did hear some of Faulty's commentary the other day, and he was talking about how he interviewed me after I lost that match, 6-5, and how he was impressed with how I controlled myself, because... Yeah. Terry, the referee, Camerari, he called a miss the first time, second time, but not the third time. And in the heat of the moment, you could have argued about it.
Mm.
And I was, when he didn't call it, I just got on with it. I said, all right, okay, no problem. Played my shot. Well, I lost the match, but literally as I walked through the double doors at the Barbican, there's Neil standing there with a microphone right under my nose, and I think he was hoping that I was going to flare up, and I didn't. And I just basically said, yeah, referee's decision, that's it. I could argue until I was Papa Smurf in the face. It wouldn't have changed anything. So all I said was at the end of that interview, I just said, next ranking event I play in, I'm winning. Because I knew I was ready, and I qualified for the German Masters, and I booked my flight to go on the Tuesday, because obviously it started on the Wednesday. Booked Tuesday, and I do provisional booking. I might say I'll book for Friday, give myself a couple of days.
And I said, no, I'm booking for Monday. This is my event. I'm winning this. I said, no one's stopping me. And yeah, it was by far the best 5 days I've ever experienced. Mm. And for it to be in a venue like the Tempodrome, where the German fans absolutely love snooker. And I mean properly love it. They're so respectful, knowledgeable, everything. And I think a few years ago, I think I kind of took to them as well as they took to me, because Judd was playing Ronnie at one of the years I played there, and they didn't come out and do an autograph session, and I was just like pottering around doing my normal stuff, just doing nothing really. And I signed up one or two autograph books, done a couple of photos, and Jürgen Kessler come up to me, said, do you want to do the offer? I said, yeah, okay, no problem. Not a problem. Said, you won't get paid for it. I wouldn't want to be paid for it. It's my pleasure. And I think that somebody said to me that they'd done like a German blog, snooker blog thing the next day, and they appreciated how much time and effort I took to do all 1,500 people. Didn't leave anybody out. And I think that kind of won them over. And when I beat Judd in the quarters of the German Masters that year, when I won it, you could tell that the German fans loved it. Mm. They had a very soft spot for me. And yeah, it was one of those achievements where I was like, I just remember before the final started, standing on top of that that row there, and I can hear the crowd like really getting pumped up. Mm. And I could feel the hairs on the back of my neck. They were literally about 8 foot tall. Mm. I was like, wow, this is going to be unbelievable. Started off a bit sluggish, but worked my way into the match, and thankfully got to show that trophy to everybody in that crowd. And yeah, for anywhere to win a ranking event, particularly a first one, besides your main big venues, without doubt, I'm so happy it was there. Mm. Really happy.
That's a great high point of your career, of course. You've spoken more recently of lower times. Snooker, it's a very individual sport, isn't it? You spend a lot of time, even just playing on your own. You know, you sat in the chair a long time. Tournaments, it might sound glamorous flying around the world, but it's basically airports and hotels and sort of killing time. And also, if you lose in an event like China, you know, you just want to get home, but it takes the best part of a day. I just wonder, Martin, when you first sort of felt that you had a problem?
It's pretty hard to kind of finger point it. Like you say, it's a lot of planes, trains and automobiles. I try and explain to a few people, like my one of my best mates, Ian Daniel, who lives in Scotland. I'm always talking to him because he suffers as well, not just me. He suffers with some OCD and a few other bits and pieces, so we tend to try and talk to each other and try and perk each other up if either of us are feeling down. And I tried to explain to him about the travelling and stuff like that, because there's been a few times before I come public about what's going on. I said, I just don't want to do travelling. Mm. He's gone, you must love it. I'm like, I don't. I hate it. It got to the point where I started to, like, if, for instance, if I'd lost first match in China, I'd ring my travel agent and I'd say, look, when can I get home? And they go, well, there's a flight at this time and there's a flight at that time. And it'd be a case of, like, the first flight might get me home, say, 4 o'clock the next day, and the other one will get me home sort of 1 o'clock. And I'd pay, like, sort of ridiculous money to get that 1 o'clock one home, rather than just saying, well, an extra couple of hours ain't going to hurt. Mm. I just want to get home. I'd paid stupid money at times to just change flights, just to get away. I think some of it, I had a brief chat with my sister a couple of weeks ago. I think some of it may have stemmed, I know it's a long time ago, but I didn't really grieve when my mum passed away. Mm-hmm. I just got on with life. Maybe that had some kind of bearing on it. Just things had started to hit me properly, and I was finding myself looking at events, and like Welsh Open was another prime example last season. I drew Bingham in the first round. I booked my train to go up, and halfway up I was already on train line looking, right, I'm playing Bingham at 4:30. if I get pumped 4-0, 4-1, I'll be on the train and by, say, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and I'll be home that night. And I'm, it got to, and like, I'd done that a few times with events. I just like, got, once I got on the table, I was all right. But it's the lead up to it, like thinking, oh, I just don't want to travel that way. Like, train rides are normally nice and comfortable, headphones on, iPad on, watch film. I just wasn't enjoying travelling. Wasn't enjoying going up the club. I'd go up the club and be in there about 20 minutes, half an hour, and I'm trying to find an excuse to get out. I'm trying to, like, just make up. I think I've had 4 new washing machines, a couple of new ovens, a couple of this. I've got a delivery of this coming, and yeah, and so on. And it gets to the point where I think people started to work out, you're making an awful lot of excuses here. Mm.
But it's interesting because one of the things you said at the Crucible was that you were hiding it well. You were sort of finding ways of hiding it. And that, I guess, ties into what you also said about it's difficult to just talk about it, particularly it seems for men. So you were finding ways to try and cover yourself.
Yeah, my dad used to ask me questions. He'd be like, I'm pretty sure he must have worked out something wasn't right. He just didn't really want to, I suppose he didn't really want me to answer it more than anything. My dad's the first person who basically messages me once I finish the match, whether it be well done or unlucky. A couple of times I sent him messages back after I, especially if I'd lost, I'd just send him a pile of rubbish. And like, he'd ring me and be like, what are you on about? I said, well, I don't deserve to win when I play like that. And then like, there was a couple of times he'd ring me and he'd say like, is everything alright? Yeah, everything's fine, everything rosy. He's gone, you sure? And I went, yep, I'm fine. Happy as Larry. I knew I wasn't. Mm. But I think it was the fact that no one had really like pressured me into a corner and said, like, I think something's wrong. Mm. And like, because everything was all on the phone, they're not seeing your emotions and how you're reacting to certain questions. Yeah. So that was one good way of blocking it. But I think I've heard you even mention it, like, I don't give an awful lot away anyway when I'm playing, particularly when I'm playing, and I don't give an awful lot away when I'm away from the table.
But I think that's the thing about snooker, like, and you associate it with, for example, Steve Davis. It's all about actually bottling up emotions, isn't it? Keeping them inside. I guess the problem, though, when you do that is there's no outlet for them.
No.
So, and that, if that transfers to real life, then you will have problems.
Yeah. At the shootout, for instance, if it weren't for the fact that I'd had a couple of beers, I don't know if I would have said anything. Mm. I was with two friends of mine, very good friends of mine, two of my golf buddies, rather, and we're at the shootout. I'd lost to Higginson. It coincided with the fact that I knew I had a problem with my eyes as well, so I couldn't see what I was doing. Literally, like, everything was a blur, and I'm like, right, that needs to change. And I could tell that Watford, where it was at the Coliseum, I live 10 minutes away. I didn't want to be there. I just couldn't wait to get out. I arrived there and I jokingly said to Mark when I arrived, I've gone to him, can I go home now? He was like, you just got here. I was like, yeah, I want to go home. So as the evening progressed, we sat in me and the two mates sat in the players' lounge, and we were like, I said to them, what's the plans for the evening? They go, whatever you want to do, we're happy with. Fancy a couple of pints, maybe? So the first one came, that went down rather well. Second one arrived. By the time I spoke to him, I'd probably had about 7 or 8.
We're talking about Mark Williams, who's not the world champion, but he's a security guard.
Yeah, the security guard, yeah.
For Will Snooker.
Yeah, I'd had about 7 or 8 pints. Seen a couple of people that I knew, they were waiting to go back into the auditorium because they'd missed the frame, so they were waiting. And like, I spoke to them briefly, and I think that I'd actually started to say a few things that I shouldn't have done to them. And I was kind of like, we look forward to seeing you play here next year. I said, oh, I won't be playing here next year. And they were, no, you will be. Like, trust me, I will not be playing next year. I think that kind of hit them a little bit, and they were like, because I think I was quite authoritative with how I was speaking as well. So as the evening progressed, I seen Mark, and I think I'd just been outside for a cigarette and just some fresh air. And I walked in and I just went, I seen Mark on his own and I thought, I've got to say something. And I said, Mark, can I have a word? And I said, look, something's not right. I said, I haven't felt right for months. I don't want to play snooker, I don't want to travel, I don't want to practice, I don't want to do anything. I said, if I'm at home, I'm in comfort zone. I kind of got to the position where I felt like becoming a hermit. Didn't want to leave. Obviously, I'd pop out to go and get little bits and pieces, bread, milk, your essentials sort of thing. And I spoke to him and I just remember the look on his face and he was like in utter shell shock. Blimey, you've been hiding that well for a few months, because every time we see you, you always seem cheerful, always talkative, you always be nice and polite to everyone. Like, yeah, what I can do, well, that's how I'm supposed to act anyway. So I was like, that's not a problem for me. I knew something wasn't right, and I pulled him. Next day, I won't lie, I did wake up quite late. I did wake up with a bad head.
Yeah.
And I'd had about 10-15 missed calls from my dad, so my dad started to panic. And that coincided with the fact of then Neil Tompkins rung me that night, and he said, well, Mark's spoken to me, and I had I think I was on the phone to Neil for about an hour and a half, just explaining bits and pieces. So he put me through to Sporting Chance, spoke to them, I went to see my own doctor. But then my dad rung me again on the Sunday morning, and that was when he finally bit the bullet and he went, right, I'm not getting off. If you don't answer me on the phone, I'm driving down to you to come and speak to you. So he said, what's going on? I said, I don't want to play. I just told him, I said, I haven't slept properly for months. My body felt like, it was going to give up. I've never felt pain like it in my legs or anything. I'd lay in bed and I'd be like, I'd just get into bed and I feel as if I'm getting comfortable, and then my legs start aching and I'm like, I've got to go for a little walk around again. And I'd go to sleep at like 10 o'clock at night and I'd wake up at like 2:30 and I'd be watching TV till 6 in the morning. Then I might nod off again for a brief hour or two, and then I'd just get up, and instead of staying in bed all day, I'd just go and sit on the sofa. That was my daily routine. I was like, well, I'm not going to go up in the club because I'm knackered. I couldn't sleep. It was nice to talk to someone, because as soon as I think I did speak to someone about it, whether it being Mark Williams or doctors or anyone from Sporting Chance, I was like, it felt like 20 stone had been lifted off my shoulders. I felt light, and I didn't, certain other parts of me didn't ache as much. So I went and saw the doctor. I got him to do some blood tests and stuff. It did turn out I was very low on vitamin D, which is, I did some checking up on it, and it's something where it can cause your body to ache, you can feel, and you certainly don't sleep. So that was playing up. Also in that time, my back was playing up, my neck was playing up. I was constantly seeing my osteopath, Jason Clemo, weekly, sometimes twice a week, I felt like if I didn't see him, I couldn't play snooker, because literally I'd bend down and I wasn't sure if I was going to get back up again. I just felt like there was a load of little trigger things that was all happening at once, and it just all blew up. And it got to the point where I just knew I had to get something done. Otherwise, I'm not saying that I would have done anything stupid or anything like that. I've never got into that position, but I got too comfortable in my own way of living, and I don't think I would have come out of it otherwise. I would have been just one of those type of people that just don't leave the house, apart from, it might have even became a case that I'd start getting shopping and everything all delivered, so that way I don't have to leave the house. So I was kind of glad that I did manage to get speaking to someone, and a couple of other friends, very good friends of mine, I spoke to them as well, and we got into a habit of, they managed to find a way to get me out of the house, whether it be for a walk or anything like that. So yeah, that all coincided sort of like February, March, and then lockdown came. And then lockdown actually probably did me a favour in the way of, if the world qualifiers had been when they were supposed to be, I even contemplated not even entering, because I thought to myself, what's the point going to play in an event that my heart's not going to be in? And with lockdown, I had three, four weeks at home, just constantly at home. I did pop out now and again, just for a little walk and stuff. But then my club had said to me, look, we'll let you in. Because I had ballooned in weight as well, because I was sat around doing nothing, and you're going to eat constantly. I think I went up to about 14 stone, and that's very heavy for me. And then that coincided that the club decided to let me come in on a daily basis, Monday to Friday. I was allowed one person in with me. So my good friend Mark Smith, he came every day for about 6-7 weeks, just picked balls out for me every day. I lost the 2.5 stone in no time. I felt a lot more fitter, healthier. My mind felt a lot more better. I think if I had to have done practice in lockdown on my own, it might have been a different story, because I don't think I would have been able to have done it on my own. I think the fact that I had someone with me, just not so much cheer me on, but just having someone to communicate with and talk with.
But that seems to be the common thread, Martin, is actually talking about it, isn't it? And firstly, accepting you've got a problem, but then opening up. And it does seem that men traditionally have found it difficult around mental health. Because, for example, if you break your leg and you come in on crutches, we can see you've got a problem.
Yeah.
But it's different when it's a kind of mental issue.
Yeah.
What have you sort of learned from the experience then? And what advice would you give? Because you can't be the only snooker player,
this. I'm pretty sure there'd be... I've had a couple of other snooker players message me since. They've told me what they've seen me do is push them to get some help of some description. It's for men, it's very difficult. Like, you could, before, obviously, well, back in the day when you had more, you didn't have to be limited with how many people you're with. Be proud of you, and you might say something to one of your mates saying, "Oh, I don't feel that great," and I just feel something's not right, and they'd be like, snap out of it.
Yeah, have a drink or something.
Have a drink. Get steamrolling or something like that. Yeah. But that would actually mean, like, as much as you might feel good for the rest of that night, but the next day you're going to feel even worse, because not only are you going to have a hangover or anything like that, but everything's just going to be still there, and you're going to be like, that hasn't helped.
Yeah.
So, but for... traditionally, women love to natter. They do love to natter. And they find it a lot more easier to express themselves. Mm. Whereas for us men, we find it, like, especially people that are in the limelight, like you've had Freddie Flintoff come out, Andrew Beef Johnson's just come out recently saying that they've had problems. Got the Beef Johnson, I saw his interview the other day, and he was getting people telling him he's a joke of a golfer. I'm like, he's expressing himself on the golf course and he's loving it. I was the opposite. I'm thinking he's great for the game, but it's the thing where once you start hearing negative comments, they overwhelm from the positive, so you forget about the positive, you just take all the negatives and you're looking at it. Social media is another case. Like, for instance, there'd be 100 comments about a match that I played, and I'll find the one negative. And I used to just look at the negative, and I'm like, rather than thinking, like, there's 99 other people there that are over the moon with what I've done, but that I'd be looking at that one person that has criticised me. And then as time goes along, you just constantly keep looking for negatives rather than the positives. Yeah. And it can get to you. And it does. It's for us men, it's very difficult for us just to, like, pull someone up and say, look, can I have a chat? It's personal, but can we have a chat? Like, some men won't know how to react. Like, and when I did see my doctor, I think it actually done me a favour. I spoke to a woman rather than a bloke. I don't know why, but I just got a feeling it done me better to have spoken to a woman doctor rather than a male. I think because women know how to speak to people that have got problems, whereas men don't. Well, I know they're professionals and stuff, so they should know, but I just feel that having a conversation with a woman would be far easier than speaking to another bloke.
So this will happen just this year, Martin. How are you feeling now?
I feel a lot better. There are times, I have been told there will be times where I may get a blip. Touch wood, that hasn't happened as of yet. I haven't had that feeling of like travelling to a tournament going, when can I come home? The two bubbles that we've had to do, I have found them difficult, but I've been okay. I haven't like felt last night, maybe towards the end, sort of like, because I was expecting to be allowed out of my room sort of 8:30, 9:00. By about 7:30, I was starting to want to do Spider-Man and climb the walls. I just wanted to get out, get some fresh air. I know like we can't go out, but we've got the terrace bar and that. I wanted to just get some fresh air, and it got to about quarter to 10, half 10, and I'm looking at it and I'm going, well, I might as well go to bed now, because there's obviously that I'm not going to get the results tonight. And I was like, well. And then all of a sudden I got knock, 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 you've tested negative, and I was like, get me out. Get me out of the room. Because I think it is very difficult being stuck in that room. I brought a DVD player with me, so I watched some films and stuff, but I just learned from the experience of Sheffield, from that bubble, I thought I'd better take my DVD player, because if I don't, I'm just going to be twiddling my thumbs. I'm not an avid watcher of snooker. I do it for my own job, so the last thing I want to do is watch everybody else playing. So.
But going forward, will you find you sort of have to, I guess, almost monitor your situation and keep check on it?
I'd definitely be keeping an eye on it. As I say, because we're playing a lot of events in Milton Keynes, I'm only half an hour away, so that does make things a little bit more easier. I don't drive, so obviously I travel a lot on the train, but my dad's retired now, so if need be, if I feel as if I can't do a train journey or do anything like that, my dad will come pick me up and he'll drop me off. Good old daddy. So,
and of course, you've just been in a final. I mean, what a start to the season. Very nearly won that tournament. It's kind of just, I guess, evidence of the way things have turned back around for you.
To be quite truthful with you, I wasn't expecting to get to the final. I'd only booked the two nights at the start, because I'd drawn John Higgins first round, and I this is another thing I've heard Neil say, he wasn't convinced that I'd only practiced for 2 days. I can tell you now, I only did 2 days practice. I played one day with Matthew Glasby just on the Tuesday, and then I had 2 hours knock on my own on the Wednesday since the Crucible. Any other time, you would have just seen me dressed in golf clothes, playing golf. I literally only did 2 days practice leading up to it. But I felt that with everything that had gone on at the Worlds, not just from on the table but off the table, I just needed to take a complete break. It was mentally and physically draining. I know I only got to the second round, but with every like doing interviews in between and all your other little bits and like playing best of 25, it takes a lot out of you, and especially best of 19 as well beforehand, and the qualifiers leading up to it. So yeah, it was like sort of three weeks of high continuous concentration, mental strength. I just kept saying, all I did every day before I play a match or anything like that, I just woke up and just said to myself, just enjoy the day. Don't let, if somebody tries to upset you, don't let them, just enjoy the day, forget about anything else. It's quite difficult during the qualifiers, because you're literally just all in, it was like being in Big Brother house, just like stuck there. But it was when I playing John on the Monday, That was probably my best match until I got to the like quarter semis. For the next two or three matches, just basically just ground out victories. My match against Peter Devlin, for instance, I was starting to get a little bit agitated. You wouldn't have seen it, even if it was on TV, you still wouldn't have seen that I was getting agitated, but I was getting agitated. No disrespect to Peter, but it was a type of match where I was always in control, but I kept making stupid little mistakes, and it was letting him back in, so I was getting myself out of it, thinking, well, I should have already been back in my hotel half an hour, 40 minutes ago, and I'm still here playing. And then from 4-1, it went to 4-3, and I'm like, I've got to get this finished, because I can't allow it to go 4-4, because anything can happen in a decider. And I managed to finish it 5-3, and then I played Jan, who I'd never beat before, being Tao, and I managed to nick that 5-4. And I knew the semi against Judd, I hadn't watched much of Judd, but obviously you could see he was flying and he was pumping everybody, and I was just like, I'm just going to go out there and play my own game, which is similar to his. And I just said, my intentions are to play better than him, and I did. And I don't think he was overly impressed with the fact that I took it to him, and said, basically, I was just like, there you go, I can do it just as well as you can. Right, you're world number one, world champion, won everything else. That means nothing to me. You're just another player. And I went out there and did my job, and I did it very well. And then the final against Mark, obviously at 4-0, I was spitting me dummy out, wanting to go home, crying my eyes, ready, screaming for, like, wanting me mum, because I was like, wanting to say, he's not letting me play. Because apart from the first round, I didn't get a look to 4-0. And in all fairness, he should have gone 5-0. When he didn't go 5-0, it was like I'd gone from sort of slump like that, and my back came, and I was ready to go. And it was a great game after that. Disappointed to have lost, but we all miss balls that we shouldn't, and we all pop balls that we shouldn't. And it's just part and parcel of the game, and I enjoyed it. I didn't get disheartened and like sit in the room going, can't believe I lost that or anything. Just went back to the players lounge part that we had, and just had a few drinks with the crew that were there, still there. And then my dad picked me up on the Monday morning, went and saw me osteopath in the afternoon. And then I haven't practiced this week. That was when I played Igor this morning, that was the first ball I'd hit since losing to Mark. So,
but one thing you did mention afterwards, and this is what I want to end on, the glasses, right? So for years we've talked about you playing in essentially normal spectacles. You've now got the snooker specs, and clearly they've made a difference.
Yeah, they have made a difference, yeah. My friend Mark Smith, I'd seen him wearing them sort of around about this time last year, and I thought, they don't look too bad, actually. So I just said to him, look, I'm not looking at changing, but I said, let me go and see this guy. So we drove down there, had the eye test, because I was getting a little bit agitated with my own optician. I was thinking, no matter how many times I tell him, can you just change this, change that, they weren't getting it right. So I was like, let me go and see this guy. And I had like an hour and three quarter test. Like, it was like, literally, I didn't know an eye test could take that long. I thought, all you got to do is just check both eyes, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But it was about an hour and three quarters, and it was like thorough. So I'd done that, and he made these glasses for me that I'm wearing at the minute. Not the snooker ones, but my normal day-to-day ones. And I started wearing them straight away, and I was like, these are really comfortable. Like, they're springy, like, you can't break them. They're just, like, really comfortable. So he made me the snooker glasses. I said, look, I'm not promising I'm going to wear them. I said, I'll have them, but I'm not promising I'm going to wear them. So he made me two pairs. He made me the pair that I'm wearing and another pair. So I tried the other pair first. I was like, yeah, they're all right. And I was like, not overly convinced. And then I tried the other pair, and I was like, oh, these feel better. These do feel better. I said, the only thing that I didn't like was sometimes when I'm sat there, I can like the way that they sit like that, I'm literally looking straight down, and I can see, don't see any glass or anything. I just can see straight down. But I said, if I was to try a pair, I said that will be the pair. So once the shootout had been done, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna have to try them now. I was like, I can't blag this anymore. Can't blag it anymore. Can't get away with it. It's otherwise there's no point in me playing. So I tried them out in Gibraltar. Not many people noticed that I was wearing them in Gibraltar. A couple of people did because they saw me put them on. But I don't. When I played a couple of the matches, nobody noticed I was wearing anything different. Because one thing that people had noticed is when I was standing up, if they looked at me from side on, it didn't look like I was wearing anything different.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that's a result. No one can tell. And then World Championship qualifiers turn up, and you didn't tweet me personally, but you involved my name. And
yeah.
I found a little way of finding stuff out on my Twitter where I can see if people don't actually use my Twitter name, I can find just my own name on it.
Yeah.
And I seen that you'd like huge news and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, well,
the secret's out.
Yeah. I was like, when you said, I don't know if this is completely true, I haven't seen it for definite, but news flying around is that I'm wearing proper snooker glasses. And then when I saw you in the car, I said, yeah, it's true, I am. But yeah, the guy, Chris Cheshire from Snooker Specs, he it's not like he's round the corner from me. He's like about a good hour and a half, 2 hour drive. And I remember I said to him, I need to come and see you because I've got a slight issue with one side of them. I think it wasn't sitting properly at the back of my ear. He went, don't worry, you're about on Monday. Yeah, I'm about Monday. I'll come to you. And literally it was a 30-second job, and he's come all, and he's done a 4-hour round journey just to sort it out. He's looked after me very well. I can't knock him for that. I think he sold quite a few pairs since. quite a few people have. I've had snooker players contact me saying, where did you get them from? I want a pair like that. Kaldesh has just got a pair. Some of the boys in my club, they've got a pair of them now. One of the other guys, Martin Wilkinson or something like that, his name is, that works for the security here. He's got a new pair. I think he said he ordered them on Tuesday. I think he said something about 25, 30 pairs he's sold since the World Championship. So it's good for him. I'm still waiting for my little check for all the publicity. But no, I wouldn't take it off him anyway. When I wore his logo at the World Championship, I didn't take no money for it. I was like, no, what you've done for me, I can't charge you. I can't charge you to wear your logo. No way. Not after everything that you've done for me. So a lot of people wouldn't have known that. They would have thought that I would have taken as much money as possible, and that wasn't the case. I was like, no, you've done a huge amount to help me. If I can do something to help you and repay it, not a problem. I said, don't ever give me any money for it. I don't want it. I said, I'll just rip it up.
Okay.
So,
well, there's also no money for this interview, but I'm very grateful for you, Martin,
it's my pleasure.
For opening up, because I think it is important, as you say, to talk. And if people are listening, I guess the moral of the story is just there is help out there for you.
There definitely is help out there, and also it's just finding the right people. Don't just talk to anybody. Just I have very limited friends. I used to have a lot of friends, and now I've realised who are my friends and who are not. So there'll be a lot of people that probably I haven't spoken to properly since, like, for a few months, maybe even a bit longer, and they'd probably be wondering why I never came to them. It's because I don't trust them. I've had experiences where I've told people certain bits and pieces of my private life and they blab, and I don't want people like that in my life. I've got no time for people like that. I want to be able to know that if I talk to someone, I can trust them and say, look, this is between me and you, this is going to go no further unless I say you can tell someone. And that's the good thing that I have with my good friend Ian Daniel. Between me and him, we just chat, and like, sometimes we could chat to each other for about 5-6 hours on the phone. Could be utter nonsense half the time, but we just have a connection. And yeah, it's very important to find people that you know you can trust. That is a huge help, because at least you know that you can trust them not to tell anybody. Like, for instance, I could tell you something, leave the room, and then all of a sudden you tell everybody in there, and I'd be like, well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
I might as well have just got a microphone and done it myself. So, but yeah, there are ways and means to get to talk to people. I've had a lot of, particularly during the World Championship, not so, I've had a few since, but I still get a few now and again. Obviously, I've never met the people, but they've appreciated the fact that I've said something.
Yeah.
And it's helped them as well, because it made them want to try something. So if I can help people, that's great. Obviously, I want to help myself as well. But if I can, if me talking to about certain bits and pieces, if that can help 10% of the men, at least I know I'm doing something right. I don't want it just to help me and just forget about everybody else. I want anybody out there that's got a problem, if they want someone that they feel they can talk to and trust, they can always message me, and I'm not going to pass on any information to anybody, but that's completely up to them. But if they've got someone in, whether it be loved ones, wife, kids, well, not so much kids, unless they're old enough to understand, but particularly family, wife, good friends that you know you can trust, which, like I say, I've probably only got about 5 real good friends that I can talk to, maybe not even that many. But at least I know that if I do feel as if I've got a problem, I can ring one of them, and I know I can trust them and not worry about turning up playing golf or going to a pub a few days later and saying, oh, so and so told me you've got a problem. So it's nice if you can find someone that you know you can trust and just express it. It's not a case that you have to go full blooded and tell them everything. Just even if you do it just in step by step, just find someone that you know you can trust and just have a word with them and just say, look, this is what's going on. I need someone to talk to. Can you help me do this? Can you help me do that? Just one step at a time and just go with it. Don't feel like you need to bottle it up anymore. I found it certainly a lot more easier since I've opened up that I can feel as if I can, if I do feel a bit off, I can ring my dad and I feel as if I can talk to him about it now. Whereas before I couldn't. So, but yeah, that would be my advice, definitely.
Excellent. Well, it's been great to chat to you, Martin. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.